All right, let's get right into the Bible. You know what I'm saying? All right, so we're going to do, a four-hour class on the book of Daniel. All right, could I have a copy of the book over there? All right, so, yeah, I'm kind of into the book of Daniel, you know. And is there a mustache? All right, there's no mustache on that picture. That's good. So, you know, you can even get a copy if you want. All right, the theme of Daniel. Theme of Daniel. Okay. God rules the nations, do not fear. God rules the nations. Really, two main messages, two main points to take from the book of Daniel. Number one is how to stay pure and uncorrupted, to maintain your integrity in a world in which you're surrounded by unbelievers trying to tear down your spiritual integrity. All right? So how to stay loyal, faithful, to live a life of Christian integrity in a world which is doing its very best to get you to compromise that loyalty and integrity. The other one is God is in control. He will protect his people. Do not fear. Now, I have a question. How many of you believe that God is in control? Okay, good. Good. I'm a Christian thing. Yeah. My question is, do you really believe that God's in control? Because if you do, it'll affect the way you live your life. Now, given what you guys are doing this week, probably I got a pretty good audience on that one. Okay? So, a theme passage of Daniel could be Daniel 12, verse 3. Daniel 12, verse 3. We could go there. Daniel 12 is the summary, obviously, of Daniel. Daniel 12, 3. It says, those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Those who are wise, or those who impart wisdom, will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. And that's to some extent why you're here, right? You're trying to help as many as possible. As many as possible be led to righteousness. All right. So, the principal audience of the book of Daniel is the Jews suffering persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, who's Antiochus Epiphanes? He's a Greek king in the 2nd century B.C. Now, how many of you know about Hanukkah? Okay. The story of Hanukkah is really, that's the context of the book of Daniel. The circumstances that led to Hanukkah. It's also sometimes known as the Feast of Lights or the Feast of Dedication. And actually in John, I think it's John chapter 11, it mentions Jesus being in Jerusalem for Hanukkah, the Feast of Dedication. All right, so there's a few things that makes Daniel, I believe, a special book amongst the Bible. All right, so there you go. This is the book that I wrote. Okay, great. God rules the nations. Do not fear. Stay righteous in an unrighteous world. God is in control. So like I said, the principal audience of Daniel is Jews suffering incredible persecutions under this guy whose name was Antiochus Epiphanes. And by the way, you might have heard of Epiphany, right? That's a Catholic, all right? That basically means God came down. So there's a good name for you, you know, God came down. So a few things that make Daniel different, unusual. One thing about the book of Daniel is it's in a genre all its own. Now, try going to the library and asking the librarian, where is the section of the books which are history of the future? All right? and they'll give you a look like, very funny. That's, you know, Dewey System number 147B. No, there is no such thing. But the book of Daniel is in many ways a history book of the future. And like I said, Daniel, I believe, more than any other... Actually, I said it over lunch, not to y'all, over lunch. Daniel, more than any other book, is the fighting ground for intellectuals on whether the Bible is in fact inspired by God. And those who know what they're doing, the real anti-Bible people, understand that if they want to tear down the Bible, the first place they absolutely have to undermine is the book of Daniel. Because when you look at the prophecies in Daniel and you understand how they were fulfilled, first of all, number one, the Bible is inspired by God. And number two, God's in control. All right? And so I'll talk about that a fair amount. Throughout the book, we'll talk about different places in Daniel that the skeptics have tried to point as proof or evidence that the Bible, that basically Daniel is a bunch of baloney or whatever. So that's another thing. So a couple things. Number one, it's a history book of the future. And number two, it is sort of the final ground of defense for those who are trying to prove, trying to establish the Bible is not inspired by God. I'll talk about sort of the kinds of arguments they'll make. I'll do that later. Number three, if you want to understand Daniel, think of it this way. Daniel in the Old Testament, Revelation in the New Testament. Got it? Daniel in the Old Testament, Revelation in the New Testament. Both are largely apocalyptic. Both have a final chapter which points towards end times. And both were written to a people who were suffering severe persecution. And the immediate context of both books is to help them understand, despite the severe persecution, that God is in control. So these are things that, you know, make Daniel unusual, important. Another thing is, Daniel, it's interesting, most of the Old Testament was written to people who were Jewish. But Daniel is a prophet, kind of, is a prophet, kind of, sort of, in a way. But he's a prophet not to the Jews, he's a prophet to the nations. In fact, that's the title of my book, Daniel, Prophet to the Nations. Because Daniel's ministry was not amongst Jews, nor was it to Jews. Actually, Daniel's not the only figure in the Old Testament that meets that qualification. The other one is Jonah. Although I believe Jonah as a prophet probably did minister to the Jews at some point. Everything we know about Jonah has him preaching not to the Jews, but preaching to Gentiles. All right? So, set in a pagan nation, as was Esther, and a prophet to other nations other than the Jews, as was Jonah. Another thing that makes Daniel important in the Old Testament anyway is it's the most clear description of the final resurrection. People will tell you, you might hear this eventually, someone might say, the Old Testament doesn't talk about heaven. And that's both true and not true. It's probably more not true than it's true, but there's actually a fair amount of truth about that. In Jesus, the New Testament talks about heaven and hell a lot. But actually, heaven and hell are mentioned actually relatively indirectly in the Old Testament. I don't know if you've ever thought about that. So in Daniel 12, where it describes the final resurrection, that's the like in-your-face smoking gun response to that interesting argument. Here's Isaac Newton. You know, a lot of people, you're premillennialist, and there's churches where all they talk about is end times and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And the Ezekiel, Daniel, and Revelation, but especially Daniel, the Seventh-day Adventists and the whole Adventist movement and the Millerite movement and Jehovah's Witness, all of these end-time prophecies, they use Daniel. And Sir Isaac Newton had something to say about that. Did you know that Isaac Newton wrote more about the Bible than he wrote about science?
What?
Yes. I'm not saying he thought more about it, but in terms of just amount that he actually published. And he published an important commentary in the book of Daniel, Which is interesting because Isaac Newton wasn't really a Christian. He didn't believe in the resurrection. But anyway. So here's Newton's thing about Daniel. He says, "The folly of interpreters has been to foretell times and things by this prophecy, as if God designed to make them prophets." Basically, it's talking about premillennialists. You know, it's going to be, you know, this, and you know, China is going to have a battle with, you know, and all this end time stuff. Oh yeah, you know, there's earthquakes, you know, and the, you know, the political division, Jesus, all this stuff. He says the design of God was much otherwise. He gave this and the prophecies of the Old Testament not to gratify men's curiosities by enabling them to foreknow things, but that after they were fulfilled, they might be interpreted by the event and his own providence, not the interpreters, be then manifested thereby to the world. For the event of things predicted many ages before will then be a convincing argument that the world is governed by providence. It's interesting because basically Isaac Newton is saying the same theme of Daniel as I'm saying, which is the world is governed by providence. God rules the nations. All right. Now, who wrote the book of Daniel? Well, you know, Daniel wrote parts of it, but he didn't write the whole book. All right. I mean, because he's in the third person occasionally. The answer is Daniel certainly wrote down his visions, and in some places he's just writing a letter. You know, Daniel 4, he's just writing a letter, but actually, in some places, Nebuchadnezzar is speaking in the book of Daniel. And there's clearly an editor at some point. All right? But Daniel, for example, in Daniel 4:19, it says, "Then Daniel, also known as Belshazzar, was greatly perplexed." So probably, most likely, somebody in the 5th century, that would be the 400s B.C., probably somebody in the 5th century collected the things that Daniel had written and the things were written about Daniel and put them in a final form. Which is interesting because Daniel is in both Hebrew and Aramaic. What other book in the Old Testament, you're not allowed to answer, Kyle, what other book in the Old Testament has Aramaic in it? Another book besides Daniel, there's the Old Testament. And the answer is Ezra. There's several letters in Ezra, and the letters were in Aramaic, so they're in the Bible in Aramaic. All right, now in Daniel 2:4, it says, "Then the astrologers answered the king in Aramaic." And that the editor is explaining why in Daniel 2:5 he switches from Hebrew to Aramaic. Then he switches back to Hebrew, I can't remember, later on. So about half the book is in Aramaic, and about half is in Hebrew. And why that is a little bit mysterious. Okay? By the way, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Daniel has the same split in the same place, showing that this was something that was already in place probably by 200 B.C., almost certainly much earlier. Okay, now, I want to deal with this, the skeptics' sort of comments about Daniel. This is an apologetic thing. You know, so just trust me. In fact, when I was writing my book on Daniel, I went to my Christian college library, and every single commentator said basically Daniel was just a fake book written by somebody who's not even Daniel, written around 160 B.C. Why would they say that? Right, and so this is, amongst the scholars, this is accepted as true, that basically Daniel is a completely fake book. In other words, although it's trying to be put forward as if it's a prophecy of the future, it's written, they would say, after the events happen. Now, why would they do that? Well, the reason they would do that is because they don't believe in God. All right? And if you approach the Bible as if, obviously, the Bible's not inspired by God, and then you see an in-your-face prophecy that nobody could possibly deny that's definitely what happened, you have two choices. You either change your philosophy and admit the obvious, and I'm going to claim it's obvious, or you find an excuse to cover up and say. So basically, we're going to see the details of the prophecies in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes are so crazy that even the most whacked out atheists in the world would admit that's definitely what happened. So what are they left with? They have only one choice, which is to assume that that Daniel was written after the event. But there's a few reasons to reject that. Now, one of their arguments would be that there are Greek words found in the book of Daniel. Okay? They'll tell you that. And it turns out that, you know, this is taking place in Babylon, and Greece took over Babylon in the time of Alexander the Great. So they would say, certainly it was written after Alexander the Great conquered Babylon. Okay, now I'm going to show you why that doesn't make any sense. Here's the thing. What do you think they call a piano in China? They call it a piano. What do you think they call a violin in China? A violin. Why is that? Because they didn't have pianos, and they didn't have violins, so the Europeans brought them there, and they didn't have a word for that. The only Greek words in Daniel are the names for musical instruments that were imported from Greece to Babylon. In other words, this existence of Greek words in Daniel is evidence that Daniel was written long before the Greeks ever took over. Because if it had happened after the time of Alexander the Great, there would have been borrow words, just regular words. Like, you know, we say canyon instead of cañón, and we say corral instead of corral, and things like that. Okay, got it? So in other words, I'm saying the skeptics say these are the reasons we're really sure that Daniel was written after 160 A.D. And my point is, every single one of their arguments is just plain bogus. It is just plain bogus. It's not true, or it's such a weak argument. In fact, the facts are different. Now, next they'd say, well, the Aramaic is evidence. But the thing is, scholars have gone over and gone over and gone over the book of Daniel, and the conclusion of the Aramaic experts is the Aramaic that's in Daniel is of Eastern style of Aramaic from around the 4th or 5th century B.C., all right, and it is not the Western form of Aramaic, that the kind that Jesus spoke, from about the 2nd century B.C. So again, the Greek in Daniel strongly argues for before Alexander the Great, and the Aramaic in Daniel strongly argues before Alexander the Great. And then they'll say, well, we all know that the only place in the Bible that specifically mentions the resurrection of the dead is Daniel, which proves that it's a later book. But that is such circular reasoning. You know, for example, if the resurrection of the dead had been mentioned in another book, would they say that that's proof that that one was? That's circular reasoning. All right? So, anyway. Now, let me give you a couple of reasons that I believe that Daniel was written. Obviously, it's so obvious. It makes me almost laugh, except sad. And I've even heard brothers in our fellowship actually buy into this. It's like, you're kidding. Seriously? Anyway, never mind that. I shouldn't have even said that. Okay, number one, the book of Daniel is included in the Septuagint translation. The Septuagint translation is the translation of the Old Testament into Greek that was made somewhere around 225 B.C. In other words, Daniel almost certainly was translated into Greek somewhere between 200 and 225 B.C. All right? But then when do the skeptics say that it was actually written? 160 B.C. Number two, it's found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are four fragments of Daniel found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the oldest of that, I admit, is more like 125 B.C. But what that means is, by 125 B.C., the book of Daniel was already a canonical part of the Jewish Old Testament. So if you're going to say that it was written around 160 B.C., what you're saying is the Jewish rabbis were idiots. They didn't have enough sense to know that it's fake, because, you know, if it was written around 160 B.C., and then, you know, 30, 40 years later, it's already in the Hebrew canon, how could you explain? That is ridiculous. Also, the most important thing is, there are dozens and dozens of prophecies in the book of Daniel that are fulfilled way past 160 B.C. That's the thing. All right, you got that. Sure, it is true. Daniel prophesies in ridiculous specificity things that happen in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. I already told you the principal audience of Daniel is those people. All right? But the fact is, Daniel also includes like crazy specific prophecies from 30 AD and 70 AD. So what do the skeptics do about that? They just pretend it's not true. I mean, they literally just won't. Good luck in engaging in a discussion on that. They simply will refuse to even have the discussion. So if you ever hear people say that, just like, whatever. Don't do it with that tone, but you can mentally you can have that tone, but don't use that tone. Okay, got it. All right, so I have to give a little bit of historical background. In order to understand the book of Daniel, you have to know what was going on between the testaments. All right, those of you who have been around for a while, you know about the Babylonians, you know about the Assyrians, and maybe a little bit of the Persians, and you kind of know that. And you know what's going on in Rome and all that, in the time of Jesus, but the time between the testaments, typically we don't know that much about. So I have to give a little bit of historical background. Now, some of this covers biblical times. So 722 BC, the northern kingdom falls, destroyed by Assyria under Sennacherib. 605 BC, now we're getting closer to time. 605 BC, actually around 612 BC, the Babylonian Empire destroyed the Assyrian Empire. And so Babylon replaced Assyria as the principal power in Mesopotamia. Then in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar comes to Jerusalem. At that point, the Jews essentially sort of surrender. So they weren't conquered. They basically agreed to pay tribute. And what happened is Nebuchadnezzar took captives. He took the princes. He took the young members of the royal family as captives back to Babylon. And we know their name, right? Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael, and Daniel. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Belshazzar. Okay, got it? And basically, he has them and he says, you pay the tribute, either that or I have your sons. And these were royal children. The figures that we have, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel, they were children from the royal family. And I'll show you how I know that at some point. So, 605 BC. All right. So, there was no war going on here. Essentially, Nebuchadnezzar comes and the Jews agree to pay tribute. Now, foolishly, it's not on there. 597. I don't know why, but I didn't mention 597 in this outline. 597, foolishly, the Jews rebel against Babylon. They stop paying tribute, and they ask Egypt to help them out. And there's all kinds of stuff. Don't go down to Egypt, right? Don't go down to Egypt, right? Not all that. So what happens is Nebuchadnezzar comes. He breaks down part of the wall, and he takes Jehoiachin captive. Jehoiachin spends the rest of his days there in Babylon. All right? What's that? Yeah, right, Jehoiachin. And anyway, so then he leaves Zedekiah, who was his uncle, actually, as king. Zedekiah was a very weak king. And Jeremiah, all this stuff, you can see this in Jeremiah, also 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. So anyway, he leaves Zedekiah behind, and Jeremiah says, Zedekiah, don't do it. Don't do it. And Ezekiel is one of the 10,000. By the way, in 597, Nebuchadnezzar took 10,000 captives, the cream of the crop of Israel, and took them to Babylon. And so there, Ezekiel's in Babylon. He's prophesying back. He's saying to the Jews, just like Jeremiah said, just look, submit to the king. This is God's discipline on you for your idolatry. Just submit to God. Well, anyway, you can read about that in Ezekiel. So they rebel a second time, Zedekiah does. So in 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar comes down. This time he levels the city, destroys the city, destroys the temple, and he puts an end to David's reign, his lineage. Some of them still live, but it ends to their power as kings. All right. Now, there is a prophecy in Jeremiah 29 and Jeremiah 22 and a couple of places, 70 years. Now, it's kind of interesting because the 70 years works out two different ways. Daniel went into captivity in 605 B.C. And when we're going to read Daniel 9 eventually. In Daniel 9, Daniel 9 is written around 537 B.C. Daniel's been in captivity for roughly 68 years. And then in the 70th year, in 635 B.C., that's when the Jews returned and began to reoccupy Jerusalem. In other words, 70 years after Daniel went to captivity, 7 years later, the Jews are returning, as prophesied in Jeremiah. But what's interesting is the city of Jerusalem was destroyed in 586 B.C. The temple was destroyed, and the temple was rebuilt in 516 B.C. So that's kind of interesting. 70 years of captivity, 70 years of destruction, fulfilled in Daniel's lifetime in his being taken away and then the Jews being restored, but also in the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 and then the rebuilding of the temple in 516. All right, great. So now we're going to get to the period we're starting to get between the Testaments. All right, so 538 B.C., Cyrus takes Babylon. Cyrus kills Belteshazzar, who was the king at the time. That we'll see that in Daniel 5. And so now the Persian Mede Empire takes over. Cyrus was a very, very successful emperor. In 536 B.C., the captives begin to return to Judea and Jerusalem, as I talked about. All right. And then, by the way, Cyrus conquered Lydia. Don't worry about the details here. He conquered Lydia in 546 B.C. These are prophecies of Daniel. He conquers Babylon in 538 B.C., and then his son conquers Egypt. And so Cyrus conquered three great empires as prophesied by Daniel. Okay, great. So anyway, so Cyrus dies. Darius takes over as king. The temple is rebuilt in 516 B.C. Then you have Xerxes who fought the Battle of Marathon. And then you have Artaxerxes. All these are mentioned by Daniel in prophecies in Daniel 10 and Daniel 11. And then important to the history of the Jews is the uprising of Alexander the Great. Alexander, he crossed the Dardanelles from Europe into Asia in 334 B.C. By 332 B.C., he had conquered the entire massive Persian Empire, created the largest empire in the world at that time. Alexander was 20 years old. Okay? And he died in 323, 12 years later, at the age of 35, left behind a pregnant wife and no descendants. So what happened is his generals fought it out. From Alexander's empire emerged four dynasties. Yeah. All right, and we'll talk about that. You know the kings of the north and kings of the south? Have you ever read Daniel 11? What's the kings of the north, kings of the south? What the heck? We'll see. And we'll see what that's all about. So anyway, that's all prophesied by Daniel. We'll see that. So we have four successor dynasties and then a fifth one. This guy is Seleucus. Seleucus, who started the Seleucid dynasty. He was the fifth dynasty. And it's his grandson was Antiochus Epiphanes, the bad guy in the book of Daniel. Okay? So in 167 B.C., Antiochus Epiphanes, he comes in and he desecrates the temple. Basically, what happened was, it's kind of complicated. He goes down to Egypt, all prophesied in Daniel. And then the Romans come and they rescue Egypt and the Ptolemies. By the way, do you know who the last of the Ptolemies was? Her name was Cleopatra. Cleopatra was the last of the holdout Greek kingdoms that were started by Alexander. Anyway, so 167 B.C., so he comes in and he basically outlaws Jewish worship, outlaws circumcision. He kills pigs in the temple and smears the blood of pigs in the Holy of Holies. And he puts a statue of Zeus in the Holy of Holies, and the face on the statue is the face of Antiochus Epiphanes, That is the abomination of desolation prophesied by Daniel in Daniel chapter 9 that Jesus refers to as well. Yes?
How come when he went into the Holy of Holies, he didn't die like the high priest would have with Balaam in an unworthy manner?
I don't know. I don't know. Ask God. I don't know. I would imagine at that point, God had fled the temple. I mean, if God is not dwelling in the temple anymore, in fact, in Ezekiel chapter 9, you see the angels coming, writing down. Basically, by Ezekiel chapter 12, God has fled the temple. That's the first temple, and that's not the second temple. So this is the second temple. That's a good question. I thought about it. I'm guessing since he did sacrifice pigs and smear their blood all over the place, God's like, I'm out of here. I don't really know. You'd think that God would have struck him down, wouldn't you think so? But, you know, it is prophesied by Daniel. In fact, we're going to see in Daniel 8 that God was behind this whole thing. That God was totally behind this whole thing. God was disciplining his people. So there you go. In a sense, in a bizarre sense, Antiochus Epiphanes was doing God's will. In a sense. Anyway, so 3 years. It lasted for 3 years. And then 163 BC, you've heard about the Maccabees, right? First and second Maccabees, part of the Apocrypha. All right, well, anyway, Jacobus Maccabeus and Matthias, all these are Maccabees, that Jonathan, they rebelled. So what they did was they kicked Antiochus Epiphanes and his troops out. And that's when they had the thing with the lamp that burned for 8 days. And they had the rededication of the temple. All this prophesied in Daniel, all this mentioned by Jesus. Okay, so then for about 100 years, the Jews had their own nation again. All right. And the heroes at that time, the Hasidim, the ones who were the righteous ones who refused to compromise, who were living in caves, and they became the Pharisees. So in this Maccabean rebellion, the Pharisees were totally the good guys. That's interesting. The Sadducees, they're the ones who are willing to compromise with Alexander the Great and accept Greek culture and all that kind of stuff. Okay, good. Anyway, we're almost there. All right, 31 B.C., the Battle of Actium, prophesied in Daniel chapter 11, the Battle of Actium, all right, which was the final end. This is when, you know, Et tu, Brute, Caesar, Et tu, Brute, and Cassius and Brutus and all that kind of stuff, and Mark Antony goes out there with Cleopatra. He and Cleopatra are going to kind of reform the Greek Empire there. Anyway, This is the battle prophesied by Daniel, which was the end of the Greek dynasties. All right, and then around 6 BC, you might be aware of around 6 BC in around Galilee, in an obscure town, you might have heard of it called Nazareth. All right, you're saying 6 BC. Yeah, Jesus was born either 6 BC or maybe 5 BC. We know that because Herod the Great died in 4 BC. Herod the Great died in 4 BC. And probably Jesus was 2 years old, probably roughly, when Herod died. So how could Jesus have been born in 6 B.C.? Well, whoever did the AD-BC thing, they just messed up. Not AC-DC, that's it. Yeah. All right. Anyway, and the rest, you know, Jesus crucified and all these things fulfilling the prophecies. There's the Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar and evil Marduk and Nabonidus and all the other kings. And there's the Babylonian Empire. It is, because later on, Daniel's going to say, yours is the greatest of the empires. I don't know. Compare that to Persia. Babylon, Persia.
Well, that was because of Alexander the Great, right?
No, this is Persia, the Persian Mede Empire. The Persian Mede Empire is a strange one because formerly it was a dual empire of the Persians and the Medes. It had like a Persian king and then a Mede sort of sub-king, which is important in Daniel because this guy Darius the Mede, who's that guy? All right, so there's the Achaemenid Persian Empire and then the Empire of Alexander the Great. Okay, the greatest empire up till that time that there ever had been. And then, of course, there's the Roman Empire. I can't remember. Do I have Rome? I don't have Rome. So later on in Daniel 2 and then later in Daniel 7, there's going to be the four parts of the statue and the four creatures. That's going to be Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. Again, Daniel prophesied the future. I don't care what those people say. They have an excuse for that, too. They have an excuse for everything.
Daniel prophesied Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome.
Yeah, don't worry. You'll remember it. By the time we're done, you'll remember this. Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus, Alexander the Great, and I don't know, Domitian, I guess. Domitian. We'll learn about Domitian. Well, Daniel was put in its final form by an editor whose name we don't know. My guess is sometime during the 5th century. Probably not in the 6th century. More likely in the 5th century. More likely. The Aramaic points in that direction. I don't know. It could have been the 6th century, but more likely sometime in the 5th century. Possibly as late as the 4th century B.C., but unlikely, given that, you know, where Daniel made it into the canon. Okay, great. So here's the outline of Daniel. All right. So Daniel 1 and 3 through 6. These are practical examples in the lives of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember, two main points to Daniel. Number one, how to remain righteous and loyal to God in a world that's doing everything it possibly can to undermine your conviction, your purity of life. And the other one is God rules the nations. So chapters 1 and 3 through 6 are about that first point. And then chapters 2 and 7 through 12, these are prophecies or visions or dreams of the future. And it's at first you might wonder why these two things which have almost nothing to do with each other. So we got Daniel in the lion's den and, you know, Daniel and the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar with the whole thing with the, you know, eating grass and all that kind of stuff. All these practical stories. Then we got the prophecies of the future. And how are they connected? Well, they're connected intimately, because the bottom line is these prophecies prove beyond any possible doubt, unless you're just simply unwilling to listen, God rules the nations. These things that happened were not just prophesied by God, they were caused by God. God, at times, not often, but at times, intervenes in human history. God has a way of doing that. All right, great. So we're going to do Daniel chapter 1, then we're going to take a break. Okay? Daniel 1. So Daniel 1 is kind of introduction to Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it's kind of like different things. Daniel 3 is how to remain or continue your integrity in the light of pressure from the religious world. And Daniel 1 is how to maintain integrity on the job, essentially. Daniel 1 and also Daniel 6, by the way. Daniel 1 and Daniel 6 are sort of practical examples of how we can maintain our Christian integrity in the world, on the job. And then Daniel 3 is more like, pressure from the religious world to compromise in our doctrine. Okay, got it? So let's go to Daniel 1, verse 1. So we just finished our intro to Daniel, okay? Great. So I'm saying Daniel 1, sort of the theme of Daniel 1 is righteous behavior on the job. So Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are going to be put under intense pressure to compromise their conviction. Not even to sin necessarily. You could compromise God and his kingdom and your conviction and your faithfulness to God without sinning, at least without, you know, committing a list of things you're not supposed to do. Anyway, as we know, in fact, let me read it. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. That's Jehoiakim, not Jehoiachin, the one who later on was taken. Anyway. So Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. So who caused the Jews to lose? the Lord. Okay? And this idea, it's the Lord that does it. It happens in Daniel many times. So in Daniel 1:2, it says, "And the Lord delivered Jehoiachin into his hand." And Daniel 1:9, it says, "God caused the official to show favor to Daniel." And then again in Daniel 1:17, it says, "God gave them knowledge and understanding." So God is in control both when awesome things happen and when lousy things happen. When is it most tempting to not believe God is in control? Okay. Caesar, just yesterday, he was sharing with me, you know, a little while ago, he was tempted to not think that God's in control for a little while. Okay? I you know, you're gonna challenge him on that one? I'm not gonna. All right? But, again, in Daniel, the message is always this, just consistent, both in the visions and in the practical stories. God rules the nations. So anyway, so what he does is he takes them to Babylon. He takes the children of the king. How do I know it's the children of the king? Well, let's go to Isaiah 39, verse 6 and 7. Isaiah 39, verse 6 and 7, a prophecy of Isaiah in around 700 B.C. that was fulfilled with these four young boys in 605 B.C., about 100 years later. Isaiah 39, verse 6 and 7, where it says, it's interesting why this happens. Hezekiah sort of pridefully says, "We're awesome. You're awesome. Let's all work together with Babylon." But anyway, the prophet asks, "What did they see in your palace?" "They saw everything in my palace," Hezekiah said. "There's nothing among my treasure that did not show them." And Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord Almighty. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your predecessors have stored up until this day will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. And some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood, who will be born to you, will be taken away, and they will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." So his, whatever, great-grandchildren. So we have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, 12 years old, 14 years old, teenagers. Are teenagers likely to give in to peer pressure? Yeah. Daniel 3 is going to be about peer pressure. So here they are. They've been taken away from their parents. They have no Bible. They have no discipler. They have no church. And you know what else they don't have? Well, they became eunuchs in the palace of Babylon.
Oh, man.
Okay. You don't hear about children. All right, they lost. Anyway. Yeah. Ooh, ouch. And so Nebuchadnezzar's plan is to make them into good Babylonians. So he takes them into their service, and he's going to offer them riches and education and clothes and an awesome job and all this kind of stuff. All they have to do is sort of compromise a few little details of Judaism, but not really that important of stuff. So how would you have done? How would you have held up under that? So he's going to educate them in their culture. He's going to give them Babylonian names. All right, let me see. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, king of the chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. That's our four friends. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, blah, blah, blah. The king, verse 5, assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among those chosen were our four heroes, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach, and Meshach. Azariah, Abednego. Now, for the rest of his life, Daniel was named after Bel, a pagan god, the chief pagan god of the Babylonians. It's like you're going to be called Satan or something like that. They say, yeah, but take your name, you're going to be Satan or whatever the most horrifying imagining name they could give you.
Is Baal the same as Baal?
No. No. It's possible the words have a similar root. But Baal was a Canaanite god, and Bel, B-E-L, is a Babylonian god.
Is Baal Marduk?
Marduk, okay. Bel, they had their whole pantheon of deities.
Different.
Yes, different. So the bottom line is, he's trying to make them good Babylonians. That's his plan. All right. Here we go, verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. He asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. The bottom line is, this is not a big compromise, right? And who would know? I mean, you're at work. And, they ask you to, maybe not exactly lie, but, kind of lie to the customers, create a false impression. Or to maybe, fudge the numbers a little bit on the balance sheet. Or, this sales that are supposed to actually be recorded because, tax purposes and, it's not a big deal. I mean, everybody does it, that kind of thing. Okay? And the thing is, nobody would know. Nobody would have known. And he says, it's not a big deal. I just want you to eat this food, And the bottom line is, Daniel says no. He says, I will never compromise my conviction about what's right, ever for any purpose. And Ashpenaz says, yeah, but man, this is an awesome job. I mean, if God has brought you for such a moment as this, kind of Satan, I mean, what an opportunity you have, to spread your Judaism. He said, if we have to do that at the expense of our conviction, you can keep your job. You can just keep your job. And I'm telling you, as young people, at some point in your life, you're going to have a Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego moment. I'm just telling you. And, you're going to be asked to do something like, miss church, but it's only going to be for 3 months, and we do want you to kind of, as a father with kids, you're going to be traveling 3 months out of the year, but, you'll be home 70% of the time. Folks, it ain't worth it. Never, ever compromise for work. Don't do it. I remember my boss in graduate school pulled me in, and, he wasn't trying to persecute me. He said, John, you understand you're in a PhD program, right? And you understand that this is essentially for sold-out people. Basically, anybody who's pursuing professional degree, PhD, this has to be the most important thing in their lives. And he said to me, it's obvious this is not the most important thing in your life.
Amen.
And I'm thinking, amen, but also like, wow, is that a threat?
Yeah.
So I'm glad he noticed that. Thank you for noticing, because honestly, my fellow grad students, they were working from 8 in the morning till 10 at night, all that kind of stuff. And by 6, I was out sharing my faith, going to Bible talk, going to church, And if I didn't get my work done, I'd come in at 1 in the morning, but my boss didn't necessarily know that I was doing that. He wasn't around anymore. And it did take me 6 years. It took me 6 years. And basically, I said, you're right. I mean, but that's just, And, I got through it. So here's what they do. If you're ever in a situation like this, do what Daniel did. By the way, don't ever put God to the test. But he said to his boss, put me to the test. All right. All the salesmen in this workforce, they all lie to the customers. Give me 1 month. Give me 1 month, and I'm going to tell the truth to the customers. And I'm going to sell more than anybody else if I don't fire me. Now, that's not exactly the conversation I had with my boss, but it was kind of like that. Right? He says, Daniel resolved not to do it. And Ashpenaz says, man, you're going to get me in big trouble if you don't eat that, all right? Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official appointed over them, says, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food. I mean, if you ate vegetables instead of cheeseburgers, you'd probably, you know, really, honestly, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this, and he tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. By the way, I cannot guarantee you that if you stand up for God, you won't get fired. But wouldn't it be awesome to get fired for Jesus? I'm seeing some hesitation there. I'm seeing. Wouldn't it be awesome to get fired because of Jesus? Wouldn't it? It came close for me. I was a professor at Marion College, and I was going to share with some of my students. And one of my students was going to church, and she was counting the cost. And her mother kind of called the president of the college and said, "What's up with this? One of your professors is taking my daughter to his church, and now they're blah, blah, blah." So I got, you know, called in on the carpet there. The president said, "What's going on here?" I said, "Well, yeah, you know, my wife and I have a Bible study group." Now, by the way, she didn't come to our Bible study until after she'd been a student of mine. She wasn't, but yeah, that's true. Yeah, we're studying the Bible with her. And when it came time for my, you know, you have this thing called tenure. You know about that? So I wasn't there in the meeting, but a friend of mine was, and he said, yeah, the president said, yeah, there's this situation where he was sharing his faith with one of his students, and, you know, I don't know, I wasn't there for the conversation, but, you know, that could be a problem for the college, you know what I'm saying? They didn't give me tenure. By the way, when you're a professor and they don't give you tenure, that means you're fired. Okay? Now, what they did was they gave me a one-year extension, and the president got fired, and I got tenure. All right. So look at this. Verse 11. Please test me in this. It's going to happen. Sometime in your life, it's going to be a situation. And you need to make your convictions clear.
Yeah.
Teenagers, don't let them show you up. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, as you know, in Daniel, the stories generally have happy endings, but don't be fooled by the happy endings, because a sad ending would have been just as good as a happy ending. All right? Because what if I just simply not even gotten tenure there? All right? All right? What about it? So, you know, move on. I mean, wouldn't that be cool? I mean, the bottom line is I lost my job because I was sharing my faith with people. You know? And by the way, a year after I got tenure, I left anyway and ended up in San Diego. And so, you know, whatever. So, there's nothing wrong with having a powerful job. And the bottom line is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and Daniel had great influence for God because they were in those positions. And as you read the end of the story, you know, they sure enough, they were better. And then, got, you know, they were given this great position. And the other young men had to eat vegetables, too. And they were not too happy about that. But, you know, there you go. All right, let's take a break. And we'll do Daniel 3, 4, and 5. And then tomorrow, by the way, tomorrow's class is the part I'm really excited about. But so we'll take a break. Yep, take about a five-minute break. We'll be ending just after 4:30, okay? Just after 4:30. So I have plenty of time to take a nap before our... No, but not right now. Oh, you can right now, I guess. Yeah. All right. Yeah, you could sleep or drink coffee. Those are your two choices.